I think my cloud has infinite storage.
Okay.
Because it's like the university, so yeah.
Ah, good.
Yeah. So anyways, you were saying.
Yeah, so a little background on the Thunder Perfect Mind. It was discovered at Nag Hammadi with, you know, the other Gnostic texts. It didn't really fit, you know? It didn't have the same kind of content, you know, no mention of the Archons or Yaldabaoth or, you know, any of that sort of thing. When I first started studying it, there was almost no scholarship on it whatsoever. And since then, there have been several books published, one of which was a really interesting one by a group out of Union Theological Seminary. It was a Coptic language translation seminar. So they picked this text to basically hone their translation abilities. And a couple of things came out of that were kind of surprising. One is that whereas George McCrae, the official translator in, you know, the Nag Hammadi Library, translated it basically to be all feminine voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They found several very specific instances where there was a masculine voice as well, where this voice speaking was basically also being a he.
Mm-hmm.
And they also suggested that it wasn't originally written in Greek and translated to Coptic. It was originally written in Coptic, given the rhyme structure.
Mm-hmm.
They tried back translating it to Greek and it just didn't work. And then lastly, that it was likely performed.
Mm.
And
interesting.
So when I read this about the internalization of rituals, mm-hmm. it was like, yes, that's what this is. This is a ritual piece that you perform, you stand up and you say it out loud about, you know, you read it or memorize it and recite it out loud. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the members of my mother. And by then consciously internalizing that, you get this vision of being all of it.
Mm-hmm.
You get, in the presentation I gave about it, I talked about how Gebser's notion of atemporality is shown through the claiming to be all of the generations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I am my husband's mother. I am my, you know,
yeah.
unborn child. I, you know, and so it, you're not just all of it in space. You're all of it throughout all time.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that in language is kinship relations. You know, I am all my ancestors and I am all my progeny and I am all my familial relations in this direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so this text allows you to really like embody Anne McGuire talks about, you know, it's supposed to help you understand your own divinity, but divinity in a real sense of being paradoxically everything, the good and the bad, the past and the future. And so I was wondering if you knew of other ritual pronouncements like this from Shaivism, perhaps, or any other further Eastern religion that that does that is part of this internalization process that you were talking about, that we could like compare these and see.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess, okay, maybe I'll say a little more about the internalization in the Shaiva tantric traditions. You also see it in Buddhist tantric traditions. You also have an earlier analog of it in the Upanishads itself, in themselves. The Upanishads in many ways internalize the Vedic ritual, the early Vedic ritual structure.
Okay.
So you have, that's happening, you know, as early as 700 BCE. Of course, the tantric internalization is internalizing a different ritual universe, you know? So it's distinctive in that sense, but you could say that there's a parallel process, a parallel strategy. I'll back up even more. There's an interesting, in Indian religions, but I imagine in all religions, there's an interesting dialectic between ritual action and gnosis, or liberating knowledge. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Traditions, more orthodox traditions, often emphasize action of through ritual as a medium for organizing their religious community. And that becomes codified, you know, and then there's traditions, more mystical traditions, often say, you know, there's a lot of responses to that, you know, you don't need to do the ritual, it's useless or whatever, right? Yeah. Or more interestingly, let's take that paradigm and internalize it into consciousness. Let's take that ritual structure, whatever it is, and turn it into a metaphor is one way to do it, right? So internalization is one name of that process, but I imagine you could even get more granular of how that transposition is done. But it has to do with a bigger dialectic between ritual action and knowledge. As like, what is the primary medium of a tradition, right? There's great debates in the Shaiva tantric traditions about this, because you even have tantricas, Shaiva tantricas, who are much more ritualistic. And they say that only the ritual action can liberate you. And so, okay, that's a little bigger picture stuff. There's also traditions that say you need to blend ritual and knowledge as well, you know? So if we had to speak very broadly and thematically, that's a big picture. In terms of what I was speaking about in the podcast, I'll give you some examples. So in almost every Indian, I guess broadly speaking, Hindu ritual system, there's snana, which means ritual bath. It's a purifying bath, right? And it could be a full submersion into a river where, you know, where you worship, you know, and it could happen, you know, it happens at certain junctures of the day. Or it could just be simply dripping water on yourself, right? And that itself is sufficient, but it's done. Snana in tantric traditions is a part of a whole preliminary set of preliminary rituals that you do to prepare yourself. Now, snana means bathing, or, you know, using water to cleanse yourself. And the internalized or the trans ritual approach to it, you say, no, what snana actually means, the kind of deeper meaning of snana, is not so much doing the action of bathing, because nothing's ultimately impure. It means
And there's also issues in the background here of purity and impurity as well.
Yeah.
Which relate to your text, clearly. The more ritually structured traditions are have much more anxiety about impurity, generally speaking. The more knowledge-based ones transform the notion of impurity from being a substance to being ignorance, or, you know, right?
Yeah.
It's a problem of a lack of full awareness. It's not a problem of being somehow stained or, you know, soiled or physically, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the non-dual, the true meaning for the Gnostic approach of snana or bathing means immersing yourself in the ocean of the bliss of consciousness, clearly, right? And similarly, homa means making offerings to the fire. It's central to the Vedic tradition, but it's also in a lot of tantric ritual. There's homas. You do oblations with mantras, and you have to do a certain amount of oblations. It's a part of the earliest forms of the tantric ritual of initiation, for example. So what's the true meaning of homa? How do you internalize that? Well, instead of offering ghee into the fire, you're offering your individuality into the fire of consciousness. So you see, it's like you still-
Hang on.
Yeah.
For it to be integrated into the fire of consciousness, or for it to be like burned?
There's different ways this is understood. I mean, one of the ways is you offer your individuality is based on duality, right?
Yeah.
And you can even offer your experience of being separate or otherness or out there-ness to the fire of consciousness. What the fire of consciousness does is what fire does. It assimilates everything into itself, or it digests.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Uh-huh. So it's like it's digesting or assimilating or interiorizing that experience of separateness or duality into this all-pervasive fire of consciousness, which is, you know, all-inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you do this, once you take that structure and put it into this mode of awareness, the metaphorical meaning of like what it means to merge with consciousness becomes so rich. Because offering oblations to a fire is making a sacrifice as well. So all of the beauty of like what a sacrifice is, you're sacrificing your fixed notions of your attachments to your individual self into this blaze of all embracing consciousness. And it becomes, instead of it becoming ash or disappearing or being eliminated, it actually is transmuted into fire. Right. And there is in the non-dual Shaiva tantric traditions that I study, there's different modalities of awakening. And there's two main ones. One is a kind of disembedding one's identity from limited structures to a kind of transcendent, forever, you know, unconditioned level or, you know, source of subjectivity or something, or, you know, capital S self, but transcendent, untouched by time, blah, 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 all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other mode, which sometimes comes after that, which is the more alchemical move, which I think speaks more to your text, is that reality doesn't stay transcendent. It starts to pour itself through all of the limited structures themselves and starts to transmute them. And so it's like it starts to refigure them. And so the body then is not to be left behind, is to be transmuted. And this is where there's all these alchemical metaphors that the tradition uses. And so the final movement, you could say, is not escape or transcendence, but it's a fully imminent non-dual experience that includes all levels of manifestation and in all aspects of manifestation as well. And the other thing with these traditions that do this, they're called the Kaula traditions in Shaivism. They really do want to break down the fundamental dichotomy between something being pure and impure. That's like fundamental. And so anyways, I just see a resonance there with the text, the thunder, what's the name of it?
The Thunder Perfect Mind.
Oh, that's an amazing name for a text. Thunder Perfect Mind. What I'm curious about, what I'm not clear on, is how this all comes back to that text, because what is it? What is the analog of it being a ritual? How is it a ritual within, you know, I read a little bit about it, like Elaine Pagels was writing about it and some others. And, you know, they're saying, I think they were speaking to the performative nature of it, but also to the kind of synthetic nature of it within Egypt at that time, right? There's all of these different streams, and it doesn't seem to be exclusively identified with like a Hebrew mysticism or early Christianity or other Gnostic streams, right? And so what would be the ritual template that it's following? If that could be determined, you know, what is this performance as a ritual in that world, in that time period? How does it function? In Sanskrit traditions, you have stotras or praise poems, which are performed. And they're often, my friend who is a scholar of this, he describes them as vectorial. They're focused on a deity, on a master, on, it could even be to like supreme reality, you know, it doesn't have to be a personified deity or an anthropomorphic deity, right? It could be to like consciousness itself. But they're definitely community-based performative texts that have a quality of praise, prayer, music, melody, rhyme sometimes, you know, all of these things that are markers of it being a performative text. It's included in many traditions in liturgies. You know, these are some of these stotras or these praise poems are recited daily. Within a liturgy, like a kind of a schedule, you know, of practice. So in that, in all those senses, one could call it a ritual, but it's not quite the same as some other rituals, you know? So, but it could be a part of a ritual system, you could say. Yeah. So that would be a kind of question I might have about your text. I imagine it presents a lot of difficulties, but like, how do we situate it? Like, if I was like to put my scholar historian of religions hat on, and I imagine that I was like, okay, I want to do a PhD in Coptic and I want to study this, right? What kind of questions would I ask? I would be like, well, what are any other analog texts that have this kind of, you know, that aren't clearly locatable? Is that a part of, like, is that a part of a trend, you know, within these writings? Is there anything we can compare it to, right? Like, how can we locate it and ground it in its time and place so that then from that, we can start making inferences about its, how it's performed, how what kind of ritual model it's drawing from, to then say, huh, yes, looking at these Shaivatantric sources can be very informing, actually, you know, or looking at the Upanishads and what they do can be very informing.
Yeah, well, one of the things that it has been compared to are eratologies, like the Isis eratologies. But the difference is that those are generally just positive, you know. I am the greatest. I am the best. I am the, you know,
oh, interesting.
You know, I'm the goddess of, you know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Whereas this one brings in both the positive and the negative. It brings in the tension of the opposites.
But that's an interesting, genre. See, but that's a great thing to, like, how can you, okay, genres are synthetic, but they're helpful. They're useful, right? So, like, figuring out the genre can be very useful, because then you can even say how it's responding or innovating a genre, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do those texts come before this text historically?
I believe so. This text has been dated to, like, between roughly 300 BCE and 300 CE.
Okay, that's a pretty big day range. Then.
Yeah, they really don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Like that.
Yeah, that's like saying my book could have been written any time, you know, like since the Gutenberg printing press came into being.
Yeah. Well, that presents a certain challenge. A lot of texts in India are like that, especially from that period. And you get these ways of narrowing the range, right? But they're built upon all kinds of assumptions of relationship to other texts. But then if one of those relationships turns out to be faulty, the whole thing collapses. So it's a similar, yeah, I can relate to that situation. So, but yeah, those proclamation style texts, that's a really interesting thing, especially in the first, the other thing that's interesting is first person pronoun usage, right?
So yeah, here is another thought that I had, not based on any scholarship whatsoever, but in early Gnosticism, the emphasis was on a personal understanding, you know, gnosis, coming to your own direct experience of divinity. And you know, when one does that, sometimes one can have profound mystical experiences. And this might have been just someone's profound, like maybe even channeled text, you know, as they're studying Gnosticism and coming to their own personal experience of the divine, like this just sort of, I don't know if you've ever had, you know, something just kind of download on you. But to me, it sort of felt like one of those kinds of texts that just kind of comes as a download. You know, like you just hear it in your head and you're like, slow down, let me write it. Let me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like influx, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there's absolutely no way to prove that sort of thing because it's just such a personal. But you know, the idea of it, you know, it could have started that way, but then, you know, become ritualized or part of, you know, this Gnostic treasure trove that they found.
Yeah, I think this whole there's something in here. There's some texts that I study where you get this feeling of like this immediacy. I think there's a valid way of exploring to what extent is this like a premeditated work that's trying to make theological statements and is responding to things versus something that's just like gushing, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that's just completely subjective. I think that there's criteria for starting to do that. The scholarly approach is to not immediately assume that, right? And to say, what could it be responding to? And even if it's gushing, it's coming through a being who's within a world who clearly is aware of many different things. So yeah, it can still be in dialogue with these things as it's gushing too. But I get that just my one read through. I got that, my hairs were standing on end in certain moments. You know, it's like, whoa, this is a powerful text, you know? And then there's a further question that you raised about the reception history and how it can be ritualized or otherwise, you know? But this emphasis on, in Sanskrit, it's like Swanu Bhava. It's like one's innate experience versus in different technologies for making revelatory truths a first person experience versus a third person experience, a second or third person experience. It's something that I think that I see in Abhinavagupta's non-dual stotras. I've been reading them lately, and he constantly plays with the pronouns. He plays with this idea of like the paradox of a relationship to God or to the supreme deity, which is basically not a relationship because he's standing in that being, you know, mm-hmm. as that being and speaking as that being at the very same moment. And the way he moves between pronouns, and then you imagine this in a performative context where you're a later person's chanting it and they're using the first person pronoun. As soon as they say, I, you know, am the all pervasive self or whatever, you know, that includes all things, like, and then there's potentially in a ripe audience or in a ripe devotee, right? There's the possibility from it going from either Abhinavagupta's inspiring text or, you know, a praise to this deity to this innate direct experience, unmediated direct experience of I am speaking as that reality right now. And he particularly has, you could say, just technologies or different ways of doing that, and he theorizes a lot about it, actually, even in his poetics. Something I'm working on right now is his notion of transmission of the experience of beauty. When you're listening to a play or watching a play or reading or hearing a poem, there's this transformation where it goes from a content about something else to the immediacy of like you're just immersed in it, right? Mm-hmm. And he calls it sankranti, this transference or transmission. So what's interesting about the tradition around him is that he's theorizing this stuff. he's not just doing it and helping to evoke it. He's actually also theoretically saying, well, what is that process? How does it work? What are the mechanics of that? You know, which is something I'm writing a paper on this very thing. But even just to give you an example of this pronoun thing, I've been tracking it. For example, like the second verse of the Bhairava Stava, he says, he's addressing Shiva. By the power of your grace, this entire world now shines as you. In you, dear Shiva, are forever myself. Therefore, for me, everything is one with the self. So it's like you, all of this universe, and the self are one, right? What am I praising anymore? I can't distinguish between those things anymore, right? And then that's Abhinavagupta's voice saying that I, right? Mm-hmm. And then as that's reenacted by later people who would perform or recite this poem, this praise poem, you could imagine that's the ideal performance. Yeah, would be to enact that internally, not just externally. Yeah.
Right, right. And getting that there is no difference between I and you and it in terms of pronouns, is, you know, like step one or two on the path to like living non-duality, you know, like becoming non-dual yourself toward, you know, in Jung's terms, it would be, you know, the, which one is it? There's the unio mentalis, which is the integration of anima and animus within the self. There's the coniunctio oppositorum, which is the union of self and environment. And then there's the unio mystica, which is the union of yourself and consciousness.
Yeah, in Abhinavagupta's terms, there's like, there's different thresholds of self that have different perimeters of inclusivity, you could say.
Yeah.
You know,
that's exactly what I just went through. Yeah,
different. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's like it's union with the self, or maybe the becoming into the foreground or the manifestation of the self that is all inclusive. Yeah, but yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what consciousness would be. But for the Shaivas, less so for the Tantric Buddhists, that's experienced as I. They're very clearly say it's ahanta. It's like, so it's, you know, it's not like all, anyways, it's a subtle distinction maybe, but not like all the three pronouns disappear. It's that they all get enveloped in this all-encompassing I. An I that experiences is like utterly, it's like this plenum, right? Because yeah. it includes the entire immanent universe. It's not, right? It's not yeah. something beyond it in any way, shape, or form. It is, but it permeates it. But yeah, it can't be reduced to it, but it permeates it. And that's in that sense, they preference the I, you know, within the pronominal cosmology or scheme.
Ah, okay, interesting.
And that because of that preference of the I, even when we say, even when our limited I is beeping or whatever, that there's a parallel structure between our limited I as a limited agent of action and cognition and awareness, and that complete I, or that all-encompassing I.
Is there a term that includes both? Is there a term that integrates the limited I with the all-inclusive I?
Well, there's in the non-dual philosophy, they developed a lot of this into like a very robust philosophy too, which is compelling. But there's this term pratyabhijna, which means recognition. And it's the recognition that the limited I is in fact one with the all embracing I. But that recognition, it doesn't negate the limited I. This is what's so important about their model of non-duality. It just isn't limited to it.
Yeah. So yeah, so I want to share something with you that I just made up. I guess now, since you're host, can you give me screen sharing?
Yeah, let's see if I can make you a co-host. One sec.
Okay.
I can make you host. That might mess up the
No. But if you go to security, you can allow participants to share screen.
Okay, cool. Got it. All right, that's, I clicked it. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just do a quick. So I have always wanted to invent, not always, but you know, recently wanted to invent a new pronoun, not pronoun, preposition. And given my interest in non-duality, this one came to me. So it's a glyph. It looks like this. It looks sort of like a whole with a part within it that's not separate. And indeed, that's what it means. It means distinct, but not separate from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you could use it in expressions like, and it's pronounced schwa, kind of like the upside down E. And so we are schwa earth. We are distinct, but not separate from. Mm-hmm. I am schwa my microbiome. Mm-hmm. Indeed, all living things and perhaps even non-living ones can be considered schwa each other. That's the all pervasiveness.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm essentially wondering, you know, about Sanskrit and languages like that that have a much stronger non-dual foundation than English does.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if Sanskrit has inherently a stronger non-dual. It's you have to be a little careful when you speak about metaphysical view and the structure of a language, right? There's been some work on this, which is really interesting, actually. It's kind of related. There was an article that looked at the passive structure that's so prevalent in Sanskrit and related it to certain philosophies that Sanskrit often, the grammar almost kind of tends towards a certain worldview almost, like, or can syntax and grammar create a different structure that allows different types of philosophies to be more natural or something? That kind of question, right?
Yeah. So
an article called Kim Karmeti by Edwin Giroux, and he shows that in
some- Could Sanskrit, you send me a link to that at some point?
I've had a hard time finding it. I'll send it right now. A link to the reference of it. Huh. Wait, maybe this is it. Amazing. I've been trying to get a... No. If you can actually get a PDF and send it to me. Here's the reference in the chat. I read it. I had like a version of it a long time ago. Yeah. This is okay. Anyways, I'll summarize the points in order to make this further point. The main point of the article is like, look, Sanskrit, and you can see this in the very, some of the writings of the earliest grammarians, like Panini, who is the grammarian who after Panini, Sanskrit became classical Sanskrit. And before Panini, it's Vedic Sanskrit. So like just a watershed moment in the history of the language. Everyone follows Panini after that. So looking at Paninian grammar, there's a way in which the passive is very prevalent. And there's this really unique construction in Sanskrit called the abstract passive, where it's an intransitive sentence that's passive. We don't have it in English. So if you take like an intransitive verb, like to go, right? Mm-hmm. You could say, it is being gone by Lisa. Right, instead of saying Lisa is going to the store, or right, and it's kind of like the idea of like, instead of like, it's kind of like this idea that
the agent, Lisa, is being subordinated to the mere fact of going. Like going becomes this impersonal just activity. And it's not so much that it's being caused by this separate agent. It's just like happening, right? Like it is raining, right? Or like, so by passive sentences subtly subordinate the agent. And so,
okay, yeah.
And then abstract passives with, which is a passive sentence with an intransitive verb, really subordinate the agent. And it emphasizes the abstract action of going. Like, and this fits very well with a lot of early Buddhist views on reality. There's just stuff happening. It's not so much that there's some agent that's making anything happen, right? It also could fit well.
It's more phenomenological. It's like, it's just stating the phenomenon. Yeah, you know, this is Hopi. Hopi does that too.
Mm, interesting.
Hopi it essentially collapses. And it collapses the subject-object
mm-hmm.
dichotomy. So mm-hmm. Frank Waters gives the example of suppose you're out and you see a flash of light. You know, English would have the subject seeing the light. The light is doing some flashing. Whereas in Hopi, it's just repi, flashing. There's just flashing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the subject in, is not emphasized as somehow dichotomous or separate from the experience, right?
Yeah.
Or mediated by, so, okay. What's interesting is the non-dual Shaivas that I've been speaking about, they have a kind of syntax of omniscience, is what one scholar calls it. There is syntax where it's actually super agentic. So instead of saying, instead of centering the limited agent as the cause of the action, right? They say, no, it's really this kind of agency of this all-encompassing, all-embracing, all-inclusive self that is the source of all action, all cognition. You know, everything is actually emanating from this I, this all-inclusive I, mm-hmm. and it's an agent. The fact that it's an agent is really important because, and they even play on this Paninian notion of the agent as having freedom, as being independent, actually. It's not determined by anything but itself. It's self-determining. It's free. And that means that instead of like a kind of syntax of passivity, it's a syntax of radical agency. Oh, the importance of that agency is that creates the continuum between the notion of this ultimate reality and this universe. It's the fact that that reality is an agent. This is different than Vedanta. Brahman, or the supreme reality, there's no action in it. It's immutable, it's changeless. Any action is in the world of karma, and it's all conditioned. The Shaivas say, no, there is action, but it's unconditioned action and agency. It's this possibility that there's absolutely free action. And it's the action of the creative power of the universe. And
now, is that linked at all with the notion of the Tao?
In those traditions?
I mean, they're separate traditions. I mean, Taoism.
Yeah, I mean, they don't
mention. But the concept seems very similar.
Yeah, I mean, the Tao is an interesting one. I've studied a little of Chinese, you know, Taoist philosophy. And definitely the Tao is more, you could say, dynamic than like some, you know, eternal, immutable Brahman or something. According to at least one stream of Vedanta, like non-dual Vedanta, Shankara. It's like the Brahman, it's immutable.
Mm-hmm.
But
Yeah,
that's Aristotle's the changeless that causes all change.
Yeah, exactly.
Forget what he calls it.
I think it's the
unmoved mover.
The unmoved mover, exactly. This is a really important like space of reflection. The difference between I would just venture to say that there's something in the Tao that just doesn't seem so agentic. It's like doing everything, but it's not, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like the, you know, same kind of agency that I feel in the flavor of these Shaiva tantric traditions.
Okay.
It's not just this like, you know, infinite engine of creativity. I mean, it is maybe an infinite engine of creativity, but there's something about the Tao where agency always seems to be like pushed one step ahead, you know, or like just or deep displaced. It's like it's receptive, you know. It's yeah, I don't know. And I'm just riffing right now, but
yeah.
But in terms of like the issue of continuum between the supreme reality and the world, yes. But maybe slightly different flavor in terms of the question of agency, because the Shaiva's model of supreme reality is rooted in earlier traditions of deities who are creator deities, mm-hmm. who like create the universe. You know, like Shiva creates everything. There's this deity self tied to these acts of creation. This is a very important difference with Buddhist Tantra. All the Buddhist deities in tantric traditions are modeled off after Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. And Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are never creators of the universe. That's not a part of the Buddhist cosmology, right?
Yeah.
And so there is a different flavor to identify with the tantric Buddhist deity at the heart of all reality, at the heart of the mandala, right? Than it is to identify with a Shaiva tantric deity, because then you're identifying with the very core of the creative process, right? The act of creating the universe. You've gone to the very center of, you know, the all-pervading center, the all-embracing center of creativity itself. Now, that's why I'm more resonant with Shaiva Tantra than Buddhist Tantra. I love Buddhist. I'm like infinitely jealous of the Buddhist tantric traditions because of their continuity of, especially through preserved in Tibet and now globally. There's nothing like that with Shaiva Tantra. And it's the most Buddhist Tantra, Indian Buddhist Tantra, and then Tibetan Buddhist Tantra, in my view, from what I've seen, is the most sophisticated contemplative systems ever. They get the gold because they just kept developing them for centuries. Like, it's just insane. But I'm, at the end of the day, I'm a Shaiva for this reason, actually. And yeah, anyways, it's hard to make these distinctions, but like, I can tell you that there is philosophical difference, and there's also experiential difference. So to go full circle back to that article, the Shaiva non-dual tradition in some way goes against Sanskrit's natural passive structure.
Oh, interesting. To bring that
full circle. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily, it actually introduces a syntax of radical agency, but it's not an agency that is dichotomizing or dualizing. It's an agency that's unifying, you know. They love this kind of unity and diversity, this kind of stuff, right? And Abhinavagupta, the way he approaches unity and diversity, or differentiating unity, or, you know, is aesthetic. That's where the beauty is, right? Like the way in which the universe is an adornment of the absolute, because it makes it more beautiful, it beautifies it, right? And mm-hmm. that's where this whole dimension of beauty and as a deep theme in art, the deep metaphor between the universe as like a theatrical production, the theater of the universe, right? That's the window where all that comes in. And it's around the goddess traditions, actually. It's really the goddesses it's the most imminent. It's like it's like the phenomenal like perspective where it's just like it's not the kind of witness consciousness at all. And that Shakta stuff, that's what he sees as the esoteric heart of the tradition, not the broader Shaiva tradition.
I can get that because, you know, an experience of true beauty just melts all the boundaries, you know, like you're just there going, you know, and it's.
And yet it preserves particularity too.
Yeah.
It's in dialogue with particularity. It's both of those.
It's both and.
It's not a complete dissolution into some like samadhi, right? It's like,
it's
the dissolution and yet everything's still shining in its particularity too. It's, you know, like that's the aesthetic non-dual, you know, flavor. That's, mwah. It's so good. Yeah. That's the thing about the aesthetic, I think, is that it involves the senses as well.
Yeah,
they have these traditions about the senses are, and one of the internalizations, they have these like cosmologies that are empowered. The universe is, you know, populated by these Shaktis, these powers, these goddesses, right? And they kind of run the show. They're like, they're animating everything and, you know, like, right? And it's just like, it's this empowered universe that's just like filled with these like energies and these powers. It's a very tantric universe. But when you internalize that, then those goddesses become the goddesses of the senses, right? And it's this like a chakra, it's this wheel of the senses. And they're like beams that are coming like light through your senses, enjoying, you know, the universe. Now, what's interesting is that the goddesses can be terrifying and they can be binding, right? The energy of the senses can bind you if you have a certain relationship, right? It can trap you.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also release you when you have a different relationship. So the idea is to not just simply, you know, enjoy the senses, but it's through a kind of deep meditative discipline to experience yourself as the consciousness that is like scintillating through the senses at the heart of all of these powers, and to experience the senses as goddesses, to experience the mind as chitti, as like this creative consciousness, not just as your mind where you personalize it, right? So for a shift from content to process and a completely different experience, internalizing the deities and seeing yourself as at the heart of that radiant network. And then the goddesses aesthetically enjoy the universe, which now has been transformed, right, into nectar. This is like this really beautiful example of internalization of goddesses as the powers of the senses. Anyways, all just to build on this thing around the aesthetic. Aesthesis is like a term that I think fits because it's not just limited to art or human, you know, notions of beauty, right? It's actually expanded to the way in which the senses are the light that illuminate the entire manifold of our experience of phenomenal reality and shifting our relationship to that. And a model of being able to relish and savor every single experience, and no matter what its form it takes, like kind of like the thunder. So I think we're both dancing around a kind of imminent non-duality, right, in these traditions that I do think is a really powerful point of contact of radical imminence. Yeah, that
that challenges the subtle divisions that we set up, you know.
Yeah. That language both you know, on the one hand, it destroys that imminence. But on the other hand, at least in texts like Thunder Perfect Mind, it tries to enable it, tries to bring it about, which for me, that's the power of it.
I think
Gebser, ultimately, that's what he is trying to get to as well. Unfortunately, you know, his text is this long as opposed to a couple of pages of Thunder Perfect Mind.
Well, he's doing some conceptual heavy lifting along the way. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different genre. I mean, again, like, that's a great example where genre is useful, right? Uh-huh. Like, what's the genre of Gebser, for example, right? Like, there's a historicizing dimension. There's a philosophical and, you know, deeply theoretical dimension. There's also trying to, like, bring in art and poetry and beauty and aesthetics. And then there's probably moments in his writing where he himself is just writing in a very poetic mode, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Thunder does not have the theoretical, the philosophical, even its temporal perspective that you were describing, right, is not necessarily under the guise of historicization, right?
Right. It's absolutely not.
Yeah, and those genre markers are helpful to appreciate what a number of different things, you know, like what kind of work it's the text trying to do accomplish, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's a different kind of educational process that Gebser is trying to initiate.
Yeah.
But one could ask, in terms of final goals, you know, is there a resonance in what they're trying to evoke or something?
Yeah, Gebser himself says it's the concrescence of the spiritual.
Concrescence? That's a great word.
Yeah.
But that's why I think, you know, I would say in this, cool, great word. Beautifully, the coalescence or growing together of parts originally separate. Beautiful. If there's any way to have, some traction with the Thunder Perfect Mind, it's like, how can, and I don't know, maybe it's just the scholarship's too early to determine this, and or maybe we'll never have enough information to determine it. But how can we, the more we can get about the world of the text, the better, right? How did genres function in that world? How did ritual function in that world? Where can we situate this? How did inter-religious creativity function in that world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like what I, for Abhinavagupta, I was lucky because there's super abundance materials. We know his exact dates, super abundance of materials from his religious intellectual world. Once you put him in that world, suddenly, and you look at the history of the lineages that he's synthesizing, right? And you can read those texts. Suddenly, what he's up to is just become so much more vivid. That's what my entire dissertation does. It's like, let's think about him, not in some abstract way, right? And then suddenly, you know, he could be compared to almost anything, and, you know, you can find all these parallels, but like the integrity of like what he was thinking and what he was working through and what he was
expressing and what he was birthing,
mm-hmm.
can suddenly there's just so much traction there, right? I don't know if you'll ever be able to do that with your text, but as much as you could, you know, like with the Upanishads, it's just maybe an analog situation. A lot of them are from the same, you know, maybe a little earlier. But yeah, texts from that period in India, there's a lot of work you can do, actually, you know, surprisingly. I actually think that those other texts that you mentioned that have those first person statements, even though they're different, like actually studying those closely and thinking about the, learning more about the world of those texts, it could be really promising. It's a trope in a good sense, right? Or like that.
Yeah, there's probably some historical precedent, you know, like you know how you read something and it just gets into you and then you forget that that's where it came from. I mean, that happened with me with what book was that? It's a children's book with the Tesseract. Madeline L'Engle.
Isn't the Tesseract in that's in the Thor and the Marvel universe. but it must be from,
they probably got it from Madeline L'Engle.
Or maybe just from
Iceland. A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
So I read that book as a kid and loved it, and then forgot about it until I get to college, and you know, like I re-find it again. I was house sitting for a children's librarian,
mm-hmm.
Over the summer, and I picked up the book, and it's like, this is where I got my worldview. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So it could be that, you know, those older eratologies just kind of like seep into your being. And then when this, you know, inspiration strikes.
Exactly.
That's what comes, it comes out through that form.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example. And it's nice because it's not just like, you're using a template instrumentally. It's like that thing's already inside your being. It's alive, you know, like that's a great, with the Wrinkle of Time, you know, it's like, it's informing how you even interpret your life moment to moment, even though you don't know it's there.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm pointing to. There's like ways in which traditions become a part of subconscious and, you know, and like the entire template, you know, the prism,
mm-hmm.
of one's being, and then you're like, okay, but look at what's shining through the prism now, you know?
Yeah.
And so the more you can excavate the prism, this is what scholars of religion do, you know? It's all about excavating the prism. It's not, at the end of the day, it might not, it's not going to get you the ultimate answers, right? But it will give you, I've been converted. Like, I'm all about context, you know, like context is so vital, you know, like it really is like landed in me at the appreciation for it. And, mm-hmm. and what, because what it allows you to do is then to much more deeply empathize with these texts, to experience them at a whole new level, because you can start to actually build out the world in which they shined, right? And then then that whole world can start to like decenter your early understandings, right? Not just the, instead what can happen is that individual text, it just kind of fits into a prefabulated thing, right? But it's not yet, there's not enough alterity yet. You need the alterity of a world to displace your whole framework that's automatically going to fit it and file it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, this text also got past that framework for you and pierced your heart. But nonetheless, then when you go to make meaning of it or write a paper about it or give a presentation, right? So this is part of the beauty and power of context. It's like
with like listening to a Grateful Dead show from 1973. If I know what's happening in that world in 73, I know the whole arc of the Grateful Dead's music. I know where they are, right? Then when I hear that show, it's just like suddenly the energy and consciousness in 1973 is erupting inside my being because I've actually built a meaningful portal to that world. Right. And a lot of that stuff's nonverbal, it's non-conceptual, you know, and but now I can have a window for it to flood in. This my receptivity synapses are like on, you know, they're blazing.
And so my first Grateful Dead show.
just a real quick check-in. I have a meeting at 12 in 18 minutes and I wanted to grab a bowl of cereal before that, but
go okay. ahead.
Yeah.
It wasn't in 1973, I'll tell you that. My parents would never have.
Well, tell me the year, because that's relevant to me.
Probably the 1990s.
Okay.
Okay. And it's inside, you know, like a big thing. It's inside, it's not outside.
Yeah.
And I'm up in the, you know, the upper sections and, you know, the purple haze is just like everywhere. and I'm looking around and half the audience are, I would say old hippies now wearing khakis. And the other half was their kids.
Yeah.
They came with their kids. It was like, this is so cool.
Yeah. It's a many gen... Well, if you have a band, 65 to 95, right, 30 years, you have many generations within the fans. Children, even cases of their children having children, you know, like from the earliest point, you have within the history of a culture surrounding a band, a generational experience, which is amazing. I mean, it's like, it's insane. And it's even continued because Dead & Company is still playing and selling out theater, you know, stadiums around the cut. So it's insane. It's a really amazing phenomenon that way. Like,
yeah,
it really fused with like a segment of American culture so powerfully because it became instantiated across generations. It's, you know, it's like the songs became themes in the lives of people at every age. I mean,
yeah.
Like I grew up with uncles who were Deadheads. So like when I was like, this is part of why it's so powerful for me. It's like your Wrinkle in Time. Like when I got back into them, I had been immersed in this music when I was like 4 years old, like walking into my uncle's house in this cloud of smoke, listening to Dark Star, right? My four-year-old selves like are picking up on all those cues, you know? And then I start hearing it and like I feel the music in my body at a totally different level, you know? But then I'm studying the history of the lyrics, the song traditions. I'm taking my training as an intellectual historian and putting it on like 60s and 70s in terms of music, musicology, poetry, counterculture, you know? And it's like the richness just starts to expand. And yeah, I mean, then it's like endlessly rich, you know, there's still like shows that I'm not crazy about. It's not like I'm like just blindly a devotee. Right. There's songs that I could take or leave that I often skip, but like it's cellular. It's like such a deep thing in my body. So I'm an example of like one of those generational children. You know, I only saw the Dead themselves live once. I only, you know, it was like, I graduated high school in 95. I saw them in 95, the year Jerry died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so but it's interesting. I saw a lot of Phish shows. Uh-huh. And they're from Vermont. And I feel like a lot of my understanding of the possibilities of what happened in the live performance are informed from like some of the most amazing moments in those shows, which kind of carried on some of the lineage of like the transmissive power of experimental like 30 minute songs, which mm-hmm. are like utterly unplanned, right? Like that mode of consciousness, that just stream of consciousness style playing,
yeah,
which goes back to jazz, which goes back to, you know, arguably to in the all the beat poetry styles, right,
which goes back arguably even to like West African trance rituals, right?
Yeah.
So that is a powerful lineage. And there's scholars of religion who are writing about, I just got a book on this actually, it's interesting. It has a whole chapter on the dead, but it puts it in that deeper context. Even rock and roll music, why does it have such, first of all, the McLuhan too, and electricity, right? And the analog, yeah. It's like, what a crunchy, juicy medium for the consciousness, right? It's like, we just take it for granted if we just grew up with it, but it's like, that was like, talk about like an implosion. And then, you know, the model of like huge church gatherings, like in stadiums, became mm-hmm. like a template for rock shows, rock concerts. So it already has like a kind of
there,
you know, and the power of the history of rock and roll even is like a thing to
even holding the lighters up.
Yeah, exactly.
Light,
exactly. And now
you do that in church during Advent.
Yeah, exactly. the moments of sing along, you know, the whole like, yeah, it's like if you were just looking at it like as an alien, right? You'd be like, oh, this is this. You look at one of those mass things and one of those, you'd be like, oh, it's the same thing, right? It's like if you're looking at like the stirring of consciousness in those fields, right? Yeah, anyways.
Okay.
Sorry, as soon as I brought in the Grateful Dead, it always happens to me. I can't help it. So I didn't mean to sidetrack our conversation, but I hope this was helpful.
that was a great ending to put it on. But, yeah.
Yeah, it was his birthday yesterday. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Oh man. So he's such a troubled saint, you know. I heard him described as that, like this rascality, troubled, you know, like trickster kind of being. Yeah. I'd be up for a follow-up if you want, but I'll share this with Marco, and really great, really rich conversation. It's helping me.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah. And keep me apprised of where you go with this, you know?
Okay.
What's emerging on.
Yeah. I will.
Creatively or what, however for you. Yeah. And thanks. Yeah. I really appreciate the introduction of that text too. I'm going to revisit it and also that codex of texts that were discovered. It's such an amazing discovery.
Yeah. And, you know, I went down a rabbit hole over the weekend too, looking at, you know, well, which way did the cross-fertilization go? You know, and I didn't realize that the Apostle Thomas went into India around 40 AD and just had this huge impact in India.
Thomas?
Yeah. As in the Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah. That's from the same Nag Hammadi collection, right?
Actually, I think it was discovered earlier. I think the Gospel of Thomas was known before that discovery.
Okay.
But it wasn't included in the canon because he had a different approach. The people in the Mediterranean sort of had this cookie cutter approach, and he had a more contextual approach. Like he altered his teaching and preaching according to the local situation.
Wow, that's cool. That's a nice way of relating to our earlier theme as well. Yeah. So he was already known of, so there's other versions of his gospel, but then it's also included in the collection. There's a copy of it within that collection too, right? So that's
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I wonder if there's any differences between those versions as well. But yeah, I know Elaine Pagels wrote a book on that. So maybe I'll read it.
I had a chance to meet her at the same with Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead. Anyways, that's a time for another story. Okay. I have an amazing Elaine Pagel story. It's kind of, anyways, yeah, this, whoa, that's kind of trippy actually. Yeah, because this stuff came up in that conversation. A lot of this question about cross-fertilization. We had this like amazing salon with Bob Weir, Elaine Pagels, Alan Trist, myself, and Christopher Wallace, another scholar of Shaivism. He's, anyways, yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Wow. Okay.
For another conversation. Lovely to chat with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.